Hello, everyone in Construction Land. Welcome to our podcast, Constructive Conversations, your source for anything and everything construction related and a little bit more. This podcast is brought to you by the fine folks of Brown Edwards & Company. Our guest today is Kevin Birch with CNA Surety. Kevin is the Regional AVP and Territorial Underwriting Officer for the Southeast region. As we'll get into in a little bit also, Kevin is a CCIFP, Certified Construction Industry Financial Professional, as designated by the CFMA. Kevin also carries the AFSB designation for Associates in Fidelity and Surety Bonding. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Thank you, Eddie. Thank you for the invite. It's great to see you again. And it's great to see you. Thank you for this great opportunity.
You likewise, and you're very welcome. I know back in the spring we had a great conversation and found out that we had a lot of similar interests and commonalities, and thought it would be a no-brainer to have you on the podcast. So glad to have you here and look forward to everything you have to say today.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. So Kevin, please just give us a little background on yourself, you know, where you're from, where you are now, your education, profession, and family hobbies.
Sure. Thank you again for the invite. It's a pleasure for me to join you and to be here and just share a few thoughts of topics and trends and issues that are affecting and impacting the construction industry. I live in Columbus, Ohio, a suburb of Columbus, Westerville, Ohio, although not from Ohio. I originally grew up in Illinois, grew up in a small farming community in central Illinois, went to college, went to Illinois State University, and received a bachelor's of finance at Illinois State University. From there, right out of school, I took an employment opportunity with a bonding company that took us to San Antonio, Texas. We were there for training just for about a year or so. And from there, we moved to Houston, Texas. We're there for a couple of years. We then moved to Des Moines, Iowa, and then Louisville, Kentucky, and then Indianapolis, and then Milwaukee, Wisconsin, back to Indianapolis, and then finally here in Columbus, Ohio. So we've been in Columbus, Ohio for, 16, 17 years or so. I've been with CNA Surety for, this is 25 years. I've been with CNA for 25 years now. I've been in the business 30 years, providing surety credit for construction contractors of really all types and all sizes. I handle a region for CNA Surety. We have several regions, five regions. I handle the Southeast region of the company, of the country. That really, the Southeast region of our company stretches from Michigan to east of the Mississippi, down through Ohio, down through the Carolinas, Tennessee, Kentucky, Alabama. So I handle the region. We have 8 or 9 offices in the region. I work with the staff in that region, providing surety credit for our construction clients. So I travel a lot. In fact, tomorrow I'll jump on a plane and I'll be in New Orleans until Friday. But it's a great business.
Oh, definitely. It sounds like this profession has had you all around the country, and you've got to see a lot and still getting to see a lot. You're traveling to clients, checking out job sites, different companies, things like that. So
every client is different. Every job site is different. Every contractor client has a different strategy, perhaps a different skill set, talent. We bond all types and sizes of contractors, whether they be DOT, heavy equipment contractors, mechanical, electrical, roofing, trade contractors. So we really we have a sweet spot of construction clients. And that sweet spot is probably a contract that has a revenue of 10 million to probably a billion plus. So it's a pretty wide sweet spot, but that's where those are where our strengths are in those size contractors.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely a broad range of contractors that you all service and cover in your market area also.
Yeah, it sure is.
So you're one of the main topics I wanted to bring you on here to talk about was the outlook for the surety industry. So could you give us a surety industry update and outlook for the projected future?
Sure. The surety industry is very healthy. It's a very competitive industry, very competitive business. And it's actually a relatively small business or small industry. And it's going to sound large, but the reality is it's a niche industry and a niche business. The total fee or premium volume of this industry is in the range of $7 billion. It sounds like a lot, and it is, but I mean, there are many companies whose revenues are far more than $7 billion. But it is a niche industry. The construction industry is a very heavy user of credit, whether that be bank credit or surety credit. And so as a surety, we extend performance and payment bonds, bid bonds, maintenance bonds, all types of surety products on behalf of construction clients. And it is a healthy business. It's highly profitable. The thing about the surety industry, the surety business, is that in this business, there's not a frequency of loss issues. When there's a loss, it's a severity issue and not one of frequency. So for the last several years, the surety industry has, I'll say for the last decade plus, the industry has been highly profitable. However, in fiscal 2023, the reinsurers suffered a lot of losses. And a reinsurer is basically an insurance company who provides reinsurance or insurance for a primary surety to assist in participating of losses that might occur. And what that reinsurance does for the primary surety is that it smooths out the severity of those losses, you know, when and if they occur. So this business, it's healthy, it's strong, it's highly profitable. But there are some hot spots where losses have occurred, and when they do occur, you know, we never hear about the small losses, the frequency of some small things that might happen. It's usually a large contractor failure that we hear about, and those are severe in nature in terms of the financial loss being paid to subcontractors, suppliers, and the performance payments being made to owners and obligees of construction projects. So overall, it's very healthy. The reinsurers have been suffered in fiscal 23, and because of that, their price for reinsurance has increased, and their retention requirements for the primary sureties have increased as well. And what that has done, it has brought, I'll say, a little more disciplined into the underwriting process of extending surety credit than what we had seen several years previously. When the reinsurers suffer a loss, it's almost an automatic trigger that will force primary sureties to become a little more disciplined.
You know, not just are we trusted advisors for our clients, but we're also a service provider, and there are certain services that they need to fulfill their obligations and to be able to perform work. And one of those is preparing these financial statements that are of good quality for the sureties to use and provide bonds for our clients. So you kind of work hand in hand together, but we both need each other in the sense that We need a reason for our clients to need financial statements. You know, some of it is for tax purposes, some of it's for banking. You know, the IRS will never go away, so we'll always be in the tax business.
That's right.
But you know, as long as our clients need bonds, we'll still be in the financial statement business. As long as they need loans, we'll still be in the financial statement business. So, you know, we try to work well with those third parties that need the financial statements, provide them good quality financial statements so that it's beneficial for not just our clients, but also the third parties that are using the financial statements. So Kevin, let's talk about some current trends. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of ESOPs. We're seeing a lot of private equity. Can you talk a little bit about both of those?
Sure. You know, as a surety, Surety companies are heavy users of CPA-prepared financial statements. Now, we're not the only users, right? There could be many of the DOTs across the country require, for instance, an audit financial statement, maybe a review financial statement. And those requirements vary from state to state or from a DOT to the next DOT. Some owners other than a DOT might require a CPA-prepared review or audit financial statement. Some larger GCs, as they pre-qualify their subs, will ask for a CPA-prepared financial statement. So you're right. There's multiple users of a CPA-prepared financial statement. A surety is one of those heavy users of that financial statement. And we are seeing some trends in the construction industry. One of those are ESOPs, or ESOP is an acronym for Employee Stock Ownership Plans. And so we're seeing a lot of those, and ESOPs are not new. ESOPs have been around for a long time. In fact, some of our largest clients are ESOP-owned companies and have been for, you know, two or three or more decades. And generally, those are very mature ESOP companies, very strong financially, very strong balance sheet. And so an ESOP is a great vehicle. But however, all ESOPs are not the same. So someone once asked me, and no, not just once, but, you know, many times, you know, individuals are asked me, say, hey, Kevin, do you bond ESOPs? Well, you know, I kind of responded once when that question came up. I said, well, gee, that's kind of like asking us if we bond S corporations. Well, the reality is we do. The short answer is yes. However, all ESOPs are not the same. There are different levels of aggressiveness and levels of conservatism in ESOPs. And we see a wide range and spectrum of ESOP companies. An ESOP company is the characteristics of a candidate to become an ESOP is a company that's been in business a long time. I'm going to suggest, just as a rule of thumb, call it two decades at least. It's a company that's well established. It's a company, so it's not a startup. It's not a new company. So it's a well-established construction contractor. They have strong cash flow. It also means that they've been highly profitable and continue to be highly profitable, even in times of distress or even slowdown in the economy. These are companies that generally, regardless of the economic times, continue to demonstrate profitability, not only in good times, but even in times of a recession or slowdown or a difficult time. So these are ESOP candidate companies are very strong financially. They've been in business for a few decades. They're profitable. They have strong cash flow. They have an infrastructure of key people. And a characteristic of an ESOP candidate company is where the owner, or maybe several owners of this privately held construction company, is now looking for an exit strategy. They may be nearing retirement in the next, call it, 5 to 10 years, and they've built this company over the prior 10 or 20 or 30 years, and they're looking to continue the legacy of that company, looking to provide an incentive for current and future employees to continue to build the company and provide a livelihood, a strong livelihood for its employees. So an ESOP company is a strong candidate for that, or an ESOP is a strong candidate for that kind of a circumstance where the owner is looking to continue the legacy and provide incentive for key and other employees. It also has some significant tax advantages. It's a vehicle that is used to attract talent, not only to retain key people and key talent, but also to attract talent to the organization. And my experience is that this is in a mature ESOP, when employees know that their decisions are impacting everyone, including themselves, they begin to think differently. They begin to think like an owner of the company. And that's really what is needed to be understood is that each of these employees are making decisions that impact the bottom line and benefit all the employees. So employees begin to think a little bit different as owners of an ESOP company. I would say in the region that I handle at CNA Surety, I have approximately, I'm going to say 10 to 12, maybe as many as 15 contractors that are in various stages presently going through an ESOP transition. Several expect to convert to an ESOP before the end of this year. Some are still in the evaluation phase and exploring the feasibility and how it will impact the organization. Some have been in ESOP for just a few months or even just a couple of short few years. So it is a trend. We see a lot of this activity. And I will say that an ESOP is a good vehicle when implemented and managed properly, correctly. With an ESOP, usually what we see and experience is there's two debt components to an ESOP. There's a bank debt, bank financing component, and there's seller debt. So the sellers will subordinate the seller debt not only to the bank but to the surety. So those two debt components are usually in all ESOPs. However, we have seen some ESOPs where there's been no bank debt. So no bank debt whatsoever. It's seller debt only. And I would characterize that as a very conservative ESOP. There's no bank debt. We've seen some ESOPs where there's high bank debt. I'll even describe excessive, very high bank debt and very high seller debt. And one could estimate or forecast that such would be an aggressive transaction. And so to pay off the bank debt in an ESOP is at least 5 years, maybe seven in terms of an amortization schedule. Some would even forecast paying that off in half the time based on forecasts and prior profitability and cash flow. And then once the bank debt is paid off, whether it's 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, and then it's going to take another, call it 5 to 7 years or more to retire seller debt. So to implement an ESOP, it really is a decade of making this ESOP transaction occur. It's not a quick transition. So for instance, if one of the owners has a health crisis and now needs to sell their company immediately, ESOP is not a good vehicle for that because it will take a decade. In fact, I've seen several ESOPs when we consider bank debt, seller debt, warrants that come after seller debt are paid, and SARs, stock appreciation rights. When we consider all the components of an ESOP, some of these ESOP transactions are 15, 18, 20 years in the making when we consider the debt repayments of bank debt, seller debt, and then the payment of warrants to the shareholders that sold previously. So there's a lot of cash. There's a lot of money that come out of these companies during an ESOP. And I'm just going to pause there, and you can ask anything you like based on what I've shared.
Yeah. So basically, and we've seen ESOPs work well for some of our clients, but like you mentioned in the beginning stages, you add all that debt to the balance sheet, and it can really turn the balance sheet upside down, and that's all the more reason to discuss this with the users of, the people that are going to be providing bonds or loans to the company and have this laid out so it's understood and known what's going on.
You're right. The overriding principle of an ESOP transaction is a simple principle called communication. The parties just have to be communicative from the contractor client to the ESOP consultants, to their attorneys, to the surety, to the banker. All of these parties are coming together to support their client, the construction client. And it just takes a high level of communication so that there's transparency, no questions, no unknown questions or or issues down the road that could surprise one of those parties. So it does require a high level of communication, just being transparent and communicative for sure.
Right. So what size companies do you see an ESOP fitting best for? When they get to a certain level, what's that size?
Yeah, that's a great question. And in my view, this is, you know, my personal view, a company that has, I'm going to express $100 million in revenue or more, a small company, let's say $10 million in revenue, in my view, is not a candidate for an ESOP. There are certain annual expenditures and costs to maintain an ESOP company. And I will even suggest, you know, call it $100 million in revenue for an ESOP company, for a company to consider an ESOP. But also from a profitability perspective, their bottom line profitability, in my view, needs to be at least $1 million a year to justify pulling the trigger to become an ESOP. So $100 million in revenue, bottom line profits, consistently $1 million a year. I would say those are pretty basic thresholds. Sure, if there's a company out there that's highly profitable and they have $80 million in revenue, perhaps, you know, perhaps an ESOP would work. But generally speaking, $100 million in revenue, bottom line profits, consistently at least $1 million.
So, you know, now that we've talked about ESOPs, another avenue for succession is private equity. You know, private equity is becoming more prominent, not just in the construction industry, but also in the accounting industry, where we've seen some larger CPA firms have private equity investments infused into them. So what are you seeing in the ways of private equity in construction?
Yeah, great question, Eddie. You know, private equity has no boundaries. There's no bounds for private equity, meaning private equity is found everywhere, not just in the construction industry or construction clients, but certainly private equity has found interest and even targeted the construction industry and specific contractors for acquisition through private equity. And so private equity, while an option for, you know, that individual or several individuals that own a company to sell rather than transition or sell to an ESOP, employee stock ownership plan, they could, there's other vehicles to transition ownership. ESOP is just simply one of them, and private equity is another. If an individual just simply wanted a large, massive, big payday and then walk away from that business or walk away from that transaction, then perhaps private equity is a vehicle. Now, the reality is that private equity executives are going to require probably that owner to be in the saddle, in the business for a period of 1 to 2 or 3 years. They'll have an employment contract and an executive employment agreement. But generally, private equity is a difficult proposition in the construction industry. The interests of a surety and the interests of private equity are really different and couldn't be more different than night and day. It doesn't mean that one of them is worse or bad, or it doesn't mean that at all. It's just that the perspectives and the interests are not aligned and not always aligned. So the interest of a private equity is that, in fact, we've had several clients that have sold out to private equity. And so we've seen what that does not only to the balance sheet, but what it also does to the organization culturally, the culture of this large company that's been in business for many years. And so if there's a private equity out there that's going to acquire a construction company, you know, let's first basically look at what does that mean? What does that look like from the perspective of perhaps private equity investors? And at the basic core of that is that this acquisition is an investment. It is like an investment, like you and I would purchase equities or stocks in the open marketplace. Well, these private equities have investments, and they will purchase a construction company. It becomes an investment. The reality is some of those investments work out and some do not. And if we're a surety and we're extending credit on behalf of a company that's owned by private equity, we're not only interested in the balance sheet here and now and what the profitable results were last year and the prior year and the balance sheet strength today. We're also interested in what's the financial, what's the profitability of this company and this operation going forward, not just for today, but for the rest of this year and for next year. And we just have to have the assurance that the bonds that we provide credit are going to be good. In other words, if we write a bond today, we really don't know the results of that decision of writing a bond until the job is completed. And that job isn't going to be completed for a period of months or years. So the last thing the surety wants to do is to write a bond for an entity where the balance sheet or the profitability or the debt is going to be significantly materially different and perhaps impaired because of cash and assets coming out of the business that then aren't there to support the ongoing operations or the credit that's been extended to provide guarantees for these construction projects. So the interests of a surety, the bottom line is that the interests of a surety and the private equity are really night and day. In fact, for the surety, I'm speaking from a CNA surety perspective, but the industry will suggest we need some form of collateral. So we will ask for collateral in the form of an irrevocable letter of credit to support an extension of surety credit when we are engaged in a private equity transaction. As a result of that, we don't have a lot of private equity-owned construction companies in our portfolio. We have a few, and we've been successful some, but not many. We've had far, far greater success in our relationships with ESOP companies. My experience is with private equity is that the relationship is gone. There is no relationship anymore. That private equity transaction is a financial transaction. It becomes more transactional, heavily financially driven. An ESOP transaction is we still maintain a relationship. We understand the people that are still there, and we have communication with the people that are still there. The ESOP is a relationship-driven transaction. A private equity is a highly financially driven transaction where the principles of a private equity ownership is different than the interests of a surety. And if you're a private equity company, you're going to purchase a company, it's likely you're going to flip that company in 18 months or 3 years or several years because it's an investment. You're going to look for a return on that investment. You're going to sell it and flip it, and it'll be out of your portfolio. So where does that leave the surety? Well, it's because of that that we'll ask for and many times require collateral in the form of an irrevocable letter of credit.
Yeah, I understand. You know, from my perspective, yeah, I could see having a business owner as your main contact, the main interested party in the company's success. You know, that's their livelihood is the success of the company, and that's where they're drawing their paychecks from, and that's where they're building for retirement. And I could see where, you know, a private equity firm would come in and they're looking to drive the value of the company up and flip that investment because that's what they do. And not to say that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, like you said, it's night and day between, you know, having an owner that has their lifeline, it's their lifeline. And you go from having an owner to deal with and, you know, putting up the guarantees and the collateral and the security, you know, to a private equity investment firm that basically is just, you know, trying to, like I said, drive up the value and flip it whenever that is. And there's a lot of uncertainty, I'm sure, on your all's part of, you know, who's going to be in control of this company in a year or two or three down the road, whenever the value of the company gets to where it's profitable for them to go ahead and sell off the investment. So, you know, definitely a lot of unknowns and advantages, disadvantages, you know, like you said. So,
yeah, it's not that private equity is bad. It's not a, you know, a good or bad kind of issue. When we look at the construction industry and contractors in particular, they are very heavy users of credit. When they acquire a construction project, they're going to need what's called a bid bond, a performance and payment bond, and they're going to need to maintain sufficient, adequate, I'll even say strong financial wherewithal to continue to qualify for those bond instruments, those performance and payment bonds. And many times we see the balance sheet being significantly impaired in a private equity transaction. And then to your point, many times we see an exodus of not only the owner, but key employees of that company because of the transaction, and they've moved on. So now we're left wondering and thinking, okay, who's running this company? And in the meantime, we have X million dollars worth of credit exposure in the form of performance and payment bonds.
Yeah, definitely some things to consider there with private equity, but yeah, but it's prevalent. It's prevalent, probably not going away. So it's just something we'll have to all navigate through at some point or another.
Yeah, that's right. And my experience is that the private equity investors are financial people. They're not construction people, and what they see is a financial forecast on a spreadsheet based on recent history. And the reality is there are downturns in this industry. We've enjoyed in the last, I'll call it 4 or 5 years, some record years in terms of record revenues and record profits. It really wasn't that too long ago when we could say it during a financial crisis of 2007, 8, 9, 10, work was hard to come by. There was not a lot of work out there. Well, those days are over, and not at all what we have today. And so what we have today is a surplus of work. It hasn't always been this way, and it won't always be this way.
So, Kevin, management of GC's and Prime's risk for a subcontractor is an issue that comes into play when a sub non-performs or fails, or just flat out fails. So how can a contractor and the surety hedge the risks?
Yeah, great question. You know, prime contractors, general contractors are heavily dependent upon their subcontractor relationships to prosecute a job, whether that be a horizontal project, constructing a road and bridges and all the structures that come with bridges and culverts and gutters or a vertical project being a building. There's usually lots of subs involved in the prosecution or successful completion of a construction project. And one of the way that GCs or prime contractors manage that is that they push as much risk as they can to the sub and to the sub trades. And sometimes that GC or prime contractor will require a sub bond on some or many of their subcontractors. Some of those prime or GC contract companies purchase what's called subcontractor default insurance, SDI, where they can manage the subcontractor risk. So there's multiple ways to manage the subcontractor supplier risk. Bonding of subs, purchasing subcontractor default insurance, management of that risk through contractual requirements in a subcontract. I read a lot of contracts. I read a lot of subcontracts. In fact, I read one this morning where our subcontractor client, a relatively large job for them. It's about a $45, $48 million subcontract. And as I read the subcontract, the GC is requiring a waiver of consequential damages. In the meantime, the subcontractor is exposed to consequential damages, and our client is the subcontractor, not the prime. So in our relationship with the subcontractor, we would suggest and recommend that there be a mutual waiver of consequential damages, and not that it be lopsided or heavily in favor of one part or the other. So many times we see contracts, subcontracts that are heavily skewed against a trade contractor or a subcontractor. That's fairly common to see that. And then it becomes the subcontractor's responsibility to read the subcontract, to analyze the risks that you're taking on, and agree to certain risks. And if there's some risk that's too much, then they just simply need to push back to the GC. And we see that in more sophisticated, larger sub-trades that will put that subcontract through a very scrutinized review process, and some risks they will accept, some risks they'll push back. But GCs and primes will use bonds, sub-bonds, will use subcontractor default insurance, will use that subcontract to manage their sub-risks. Those GCs and primes are acutely aware of the risks that they acquire through their sub-trades, and they seek to manage that as closely as they can. So I hope that answers your question about how GCs and primes are managing that risk.
Yes, yes. Because we have a lot of subcontractor clients, we have a lot of GCs, and you know, there's a lot of work being passed back and forth, on these contracts. Especially like you said, there's a surplus of work out there, and everybody's staying busy. So, you know, to the extent that everyone can protect themselves to the best they can, you know, they need to look at those risks and how best to protect themselves.
Yeah, you know, to that point, we've because there's so much work out there presently. It hasn't always been this way, but today and for the recent several years, there's been a surplus, high demand for contractor services. As a result of that plentiful nature of work, it's given the subcontractor community the opportunity to tell GCs that there's some risks they're just not going to take, and they don't have to take it because they can move on and to another job or be more selective
right
in the projects that they pursue or take on. We've even seen that with owners, even public owners, who've had a few bidders. And so even some of the public owners, especially on really large jobs, I'm talking really half a billion, a $500 million job or larger, where public owners have had to modify, adjust, or change their terms and conditions that then would attract a contractor to bid this large job, because there's so much work out there. And if a contractor comes across a job with what is considered high risk, then they're going to move on. They'll move on to another job because there's just a lot of work out there presently.
Mm-hmm. So, Kevin, what advice or suggestions can you give contractors to help them navigate through the times that we're in right now?
Yeah, I think that's a critical question. And one of the things that contractors can do is just, you know, continue the dialogue that we've talked about here is to be very selective. And one of the things we haven't talked about today, but wherever I go, we hear a shortage of labor, skilled and unskilled talent. And so contractors, there's so much work out there that they don't have the talent to prosecute or pursue all the work that's out there. So the conditions really require or lends itself to contractors being very selective. So eliminating a bad job with a bad owner. Why take on more risk with an unknown owner or risks in a contract when there's other work out there where the risks are not as great and the relationship is better for a successful, profitable experience on a job. So contractors being managing their labor, incentivizing their people and attracting key people and labor is critical, but also being very selective in the jobs they pursue, I think is the ripe environment that we're in. We're just in this great environment where contractors can be very selective. And so maintaining that discipline, and if they come across a project that is riddled with risk, that they select against it and pursue, another highly profitable project experience. So being selective and managing labor, I think, are paramount in the environment that we're in right now.
Kevin, one thing we didn't talk about, and part of this maybe has to do with being selective, are killer contract and subcontract clauses.
Yeah, there are terms and conditions in these contracts that we read that are they can crucify a company if that trigger is pulled, and some of those killer contract clauses or very onerous conditions involve a multitude of different things, but certainly damages, actual damages. Consequential damages. And so the contractor just simply has to, kind of sit back and say, okay, what are the consequential damages here? If this is a school job that is being built, what are the consequences of not having this job completed on time? Well, if the school isn't completed by August 10th, and it's going to be not completed until January, then, you're probably looking at a full half a year of damages, where that owner's got to find another facility to put their students and teachers and educational experience for the fall. So you begin to quantify what those damages are compared to, let's say a stadium project where it's a venue of the NFL and failure to complete on time, what the damages might be on a large stadium project. Well, you get into all kinds of things like ticket sales and marketing revenue and concession sales. And it becomes a number that's really difficult to quantify because it's so large. It's in the stratosphere that those consequential damages are quite large. So managing damages and consequential damages, and what we suggest when those damages appear to be excessive or high, that negotiate a cap of a dollar amount or a percentage of the contract so that those damages are quantified and not unlimited. Seek to cap or quantify those consequential and really other damages. When I see a contract that has no LDs, no liquidated damages, my antenna goes up. I would rather see a contract that has LDs than a contract that has no LDs. LDs are liquidated damages. So generally speaking, when a contract doesn't have LDs or liquidated damages, somewhere in that contract there are damages. And it's probably actual damages, consequential damages, indirect damages. And they're usually not quantified. And so they're can be quite excessive. So there are some contractor clauses that are killer clauses. Damages is one of them. Notice requirements. There may be a notice requirement to if a contractor discovers a condition, they have 24 hours to provide notice or a period of time. And so contractors being familiar with notice requirements are absolutely critical. If they discover a condition, what is the notice requirement? Is it, or are there notice requirements? They just really need to understand the requirements to provide notice to a GC or an owner when a change in differing conditions or circumstances presented that now impacts the contractor's ability to perform. So those notice requirements become critical. maintenance and warranty, we see some get tripped up on what are long-term, what are construed to become long-term maintenance and warranty obligations. Even a performance guarantee or an efficiency guarantee can sometimes be a killer clause that can break a company. So if those types of clauses are in a contract, we suggest to quantify it so it's not unlimited or unknown, that it's capped either a dollar amount or a percentage of the contract.
Right. Well, Kevin, we're getting close to the end of this podcast. Are there any closing thoughts that you want to share with our listeners?
You know, this is a great industry. The surety industry is a great industry. The construction industry is the industry that we support as a surety and as a surety industry. And the young people, probably young people being, I'm going to say 25 and under, or maybe even 30 and under, there are conditions and situations in this industry that they haven't seen. Times have been so good in these last, I'll call it 4 or 5 years, that it's really, really easy to cover mistakes and sins. When times are so good, a lot of mistakes can be made and them not be manifest. So my advice is enjoy the ride and the wave that we're on. It won't always be this way. It hasn't always been this way. And when tougher times come, be prepared to make the critical decisions that preserve the company so that there's profitability, regardless of the economic times. So implementing now procedures and processes that bring discipline, I think are would be beneficial. So to the younger folks out there, please don't even believe for a moment that the environment that we're in will always be like this, because it hasn't been and it won't always be. Now, I don't know when the train is going to end or the trends will turn or change, or there'll be a repeat of what we experienced in 2007, 8, 9, 10, or 11. I don't know what those triggers are. I could, you know, only imagine. And the forecast for the foreseeable future is strong. There's a lot of work out there. And with the reduction of interest rates coming from the feds, that's probably going to put more fuel to the fire of creating, even private owners having an interest in financing jobs now because interest rates are lower. So there's strong work out there. There's a strong pipeline of work opportunities. And to the younger folks out there, enjoy it while it lasts. And because it won't always be this way. I just don't know when it's going to turn or slow down. But as far as we can see, it's as strong as what we've experienced in the last few years.
That's terrific advice for everybody, Kevin. So there you all have it. This wraps up another episode of Constructive Conversations. Kevin, I want to thank you again for taking the time to speak today and answer all of our questions and, you know, just be another voice for the construction industry. And we hope to have you back again on here sometime soon.
Thank you, Eddie. Thank you for the invite. It's great to see you again, and best wishes to you, and hope to see you soon.
Appreciate that. So make sure to subscribe to our Brown Edwards YouTube channel and watch for future episodes and wherever you get your podcasts. So this has been your host, Eddie Thompson. So long until next time.